His charm is so contagious, vaccines have been created for it. Years ago, he built a city out of blocks. Today, over 600,000 people live and work there. He is the only man to ever ace a Rorschach test. Every time he goes for a swim, dolphins appear. Alien abductors have asked him to probe them. If he were to give you directions, you'd never get lost, and you'd arrive at least 5 minutes early. His legend precedes him, the way lightning precedes thunder. He is the most interesting man in the world.
Well, hello and welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Roden.
Whoa, that's so boy.
This is the show where we drop bombs of awesome into your earphones. And we have a special treat for you today. We have the most interesting man in the world. Can you believe it?
Ben
Guy Davis is with us today. And we are going to talk his ear off about his life story, because he's got a real interesting one. He even brought a whole map of, like, people that he's met throughout his life.
Hail to the king, baby.
Here in the kind of the greater Seattle area and San Francisco. So we're going to talk to him in a moment. We got some other stuff, too. It's going to be a great show. We want to thank Sean DeTore for coming on last week. And giving us a great, giving it his all, and giving us a great show. Super, super nice guy. So if you have the time, check out his podcasts, The Mixtape with Sean DeTore, and TBTL with Luke Burbank. He is a regular on that podcast, one of the original members of TBTL.
I love that show.
Do you like that? Yeah, that's a good one. And also, he does a bunch of stuff. We actually went to his pub trivia on Sunday and just had a great time. Super hard, though. Me and Murray did not do very well on the pub trivia. We're not as smart as we thought we were. So, anyway, thank you for joining us. Once again, just to get this out here, too. Remember, you guys can get this show on Stitcher, you can get it on Zune Marketplace, and hopefully soon you can get it on iTunes, on the iTunes store. Something funny just happened with that recently is that we've been having, as everybody knows that's listening to this show, we've had some problems with iTunes in the past, trying to get our show up there. And I just got to the end of my rope, and I tracked down... or I think I did anyway, I tracked down Steve Jobs' email address, and I emailed the man himself. And so ever since I emailed Steve Jobs, I have been getting emails from technical support at Apple all of a sudden. So maybe it worked. I don't know. Steve Jobs, you may or may not be my hero, my personal hero. So... he's not hearing this. But if you are Steve Jobs, you are a man of great integrity.
Fucking crazy.
So let's bring our guest on here, Benjamin Guy Davis. Do you like Ben or is it Benjamin?
Benji.
Benji? You prefer Benji. Well, welcome to the show, Ben. It's a pleasure to have you on. I got an email a little while ago telling me that we needed to have you on, that you had some really good stories. And so I emailed you, right? And corresponded with you just a little bit.
It's very interesting to be here.
It's very interesting?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad you're interested in what we're doing here. And I'm glad that you showed up. And so... let's just kind of jump right into it. We were talking right before the show. You have had quite the interesting life. You are, in my mind, one of the most interesting people in the world. And so let's kind of start at the beginning here. So you were telling me earlier that in the late 60s, kind of early 70s, you grew up in a commune up in the Bellingham area, right?
Right, way out in the woods on Kelly Road.
Kelly Road, huh?
Right. There were several different little cults out there. There were the Baha'i and then the Seventh-day Adventists.
Uh-huh.
And then there were some crazy hippies up on the hill. So we had several different compounds in the woods out there on Kelly Road.
So what compound were you part of then?
The A-Frame.
You were part of the A-Frame?
Yeah, we were the moderate group of cultists.
Okay. It sounds like there was quite a few different religions that were being practiced up there. Were you part of the Baha'i faith or...
We did not belong to any particular faith, but the leader of that particular building, A-Frame, was a Baha'i.
Okay. Move a little bit closer to that mic if you could. I'm sorry, you got to kind of hunch over there, but that's how we do here at the Air Raid Podcast. So let's see. How old were you when you lived on this commune up there?
7 years old.
You were 7 years old, and you told me a very interesting thing. Now there was a lot of drugs going around, flying around, on this commune. And you actually stated that you were dropping acid at the age of seven.
I did it once at seven.
Uh huh.
Up at the Hill House with the hippies.
Really, really. Mm-hmm. And they gave it to you.
Actually, my stepmother gave it to me.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Awesome. I like this idea.
So, what was that like at the age of seven, dropping acid?
It was pretty stress free because I hadn't hit puberty yet, so
right,
I wasn't
right.
worried about much. I was just looking at the patterns and enjoying the sunshine.
Yeah, totally. I think that's what I did the first time I dropped acid. But that's kind of cool too, because I guess when you're a kid, you don't have a lot of the worries that you have when you're older, right? So, you know, psychedelics may be fine. I'm not saying go out and give your kid acid, but it's interesting that you didn't have like a very a scary experience with the stuff, I guess.
Well, I did
when
I was nine. When I was nine, I had a horrible experience where I saw an infinite number of female snake demons coming after me, and they were going to take me away and do something worse than death to me forever.
Whoa. Yeah, that's what they call a bad trip, I think.
Well, the acid wasn't as good then.
It's kind of getting... It was like the brown tabs at Woodstock or something. Don't take the brown acid.
Yeah, it was hellish.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So that's pretty interesting, though. So by the age of nine, had you done... You'd done acid, like, what, twice?
Yeah.
Or more than that?
That was my second time.
That was your second time.
And I didn't do it again until I was 19. I was scared to death of it.
I can imagine. I can imagine. After an experience like that, seeing a zombie snake death demons...
Right, and once again, it was my stepmother who was a practicing black magic witch.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really? So what kind of stuff would she do? Would she like sacrifice like roosters or what?
I just remember her lighting black candles.
That was it?
Yeah, she did astrology, tarot cards, and stuff like that.
Really? Really? Are you kind of a believer in that the tarot card kind of stuff?
No, I've had experiences with, you know, aliens and ghosts and things, but I don't particularly believe in anything.
Right. Okay. So are you a nihilist?
No.
Like in the Big Lebowski. Do you pee on rugs?
No, I'm just a stoic moderate.
You are very stoic. Well, okay. So what was that? What year was that? That was 69, you were saying, or 1970? Okay.
We were on the commune in the woods, and we started our own Indian tribe and learned how to make tomahawks, and we ran through the woods naked and made fires and chanted and spoke in tongues.
Spoke in tongues?
Yeah. The Seventh-day Adventists taught us how to speak in tongues.
Really? Yeah. Really? Now, is that like speaking in tongues? Let's elaborate on this a little bit, because, excuse me, I don't know a lot about, I didn't grow up religious at all and don't know a lot about it. So what can you tell us about speaking in tongues? Now, are you speaking in tongues right now, or are you just like giving me an example here?
Well, that's what it was like, but I don't believe that it was anything. I mean, they claim that it's some type of spiritual thing, but I think it's just stringing together nonsense.
Right. Yeah, and that's kind of what I've always thought about it too, because you can see like a lot of the times when they do the speaking in tongues, they're at like one of those, I don't know, it's kind of like a church tent. What would you call that? It would like a revival or
a
something
revival
like
meeting.
That. Right,
correct.
Right. And so it's a lot of really like, I don't know, really, would you say crazy people? I don't know.
I think they're just trying to go along with you know, what the church people are telling them they're supposed to do in that
right,
church.
Right.
So they're like, I have to speak in tongues. So I'll speak in tongues.
Right. Right. That's weird. That's weird shit. Yeah. What were you thinking at the age when you were kind of growing up around all this? Like, I mean, you know, I hate to say like craziness because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to offend you at all. And your childhood, but it sounds like there was a lot of just crazy stuff going on around you.
I thought it was all pretty awesome.
Did you really?
We went to the free school where they let you study whatever you want to. So I would just, you know, draw pictures of airplanes or books, and everything was pretty awesome for quite a while. You know,
nice.
At the time, everybody thought the revolution was coming, so they. They didn't think that we had to prepare for the future that much because we were going to be in utopia.
Right, right. And this was near the end of the Vietnam War, correct?
Maybe halfway through.
Halfway through?
70, I don't know. When did it end? 72 or 74?
I think 72, 73 or 74, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because that was when the whole helicopter on the top of the hotel kind of thing was going on. Well, that's pretty crazy. So what, and then you were telling me now when you moved away from the commune, how old were you? You were what? 16?
Seven.
So? You were seven when you moved away?
Yes. I was only there for 1 year.
Oh, you were? Okay. So how did you end up doing LSD again at nine then?
It was my stepmother again, and she brought it to Bellingham.
Oh, okay.
So
you guys
Street.
Moved out of, you were still in Bellingham because the commune was in Bellingham, right?
Right.
Okay. So you moved out of the commune. You moved into what, like a neighborhood up out there or something?
Right. And then Beham. After I had the bad trip,
I
had a horrible ringing in my ears. And I still have it, actually. And I still hallucinate constantly.
So do you think those are what, flashbacks? Well, obviously. I mean, kind of flashbacks.
Some type of brain damage, I guess.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
No shit. Wow. What happened that made you move out of Bellingham at the age of 16? So, you know, some years pass, and somebody came to visit you up in Bellingham.
Anacortes.
Oh, in Anacortes. Okay.
Right. I was on this little island, Guemes Island, right near Anacortes.
Right.
And a friend of ours, Daniel Sullivan, came to the little island, and he brought these two young women who were dressed funny. And so we said, what's this? And they said, this is punk rock. And so we go, women dressing funny, we're going to move to Seattle tomorrow. So me and my brother, within the week, we had moved to Seattle, and we were basically living on the street trying to be punk.
Right, right.
But I couldn't really get the hang of it because I didn't have the right clothes.
So what were these girls wearing when you saw them come up?
I do remember they were wearing safety pins.
Safety pins.
Yes, and
boy, that just like that has stuck.
And ripped, you know? Clothing.
And ripped clothing. Yeah, yeah. More than you know, literal. In the literal sense, it has stuck in ripped clothing. So you were kind of what? You were like what? Turned on by these girls or something?
And I thought and just maybe like... I could have sex if I moved to Seattle.
Perfect. And did it end up happening? Did you like move down to where these girls were or what?
Yeah, in about a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was
perfect.
Awesome, yeah.
Man, at the age of 16, right on, brother. That's awesome. So, okay. So, you know, and that's something I wanted to talk to you about because at this age, you started getting into the punk scene, which was relatively small here in the city of Seattle from what I understand, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you look back to your childhood about, you know, this... the punk music that was coming out at that time, what was that, mid-70s or so?
Well, I'd only heard about punk in 79.
In 79, okay. So late 70s.
The Sex Pistols.
Right. The Bollocks and all those bands. Now, nowadays, punk has kind of morphed into this weird kind of like pop rock genre. You know, I don't like to call it punk, but I was looking, and I meant to actually get the issue of it, but the new issue of Rolling Stone has a picture of Avril Lavigne on it. You know who Avril Lavigne is, right?
Right. Well, back then, the girls usually didn't have long hair like that and makeup.
Right,
so
right.
The punk girls usually had short, choppy hair and dressed more like the guys.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, there are 1,000 different types of punk now. And you still have the old-fashioned punk, you have the English-style punk, and then you hardcore, and all different types, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But do you consider, like, because I always see this, like, you know, they on the cover of Rolling Stone, they actually called Avril Lavigne, like, the bad girl, or the, you know, something like that. Let's look it up really quick. But what do you think about that? Like, you know, because you kind of grew up, you kind of grew up with the punk rock, and you know, I mean, you see it morph into this kind of, you know, I would say bullshit, you know, bullshit style of music that's coming out right now that's considered punk, like Avril Lavigne and things like that.
Well, I figure if somebody wants to be punk, that's fine with me. I don't think Avril Lavigne sounds very punk or looks very punk.
Right.
But I do like Green Day. I think they're a good band.
You like Green Day?
Yeah. They're not as punk as some bands, but they certainly are successful and their lyrics are pretty good.
I was into when Green Day first kind of came out, I was into Green Day. Like I liked, what was that album? Dookie?
Yeah.
I think it was Dookie.
Yeah.
Right. That kind of shot them to stardom, you know?
Right.
I was a fan of that, you know? And I still wouldn't say that's really, you know, punk rock. I mean, that to me is more like pop, you know, pop.
Right.
Super poppy. So it's like fast pop or something. I don't know what you would call it. But like the stuff that comes out today really kind of irks me a little bit because, you know, all the songs are about like, you know, oh, woe is me. You know, I'm rich as fuck, but I can't, you know, get my relationship status on Facebook together, you know, kind of shit like that. And that just kind of rubs me the wrong way. And that's what I hear coming out of like the really popular music scene right now, like with, people like Avril Lavigne who's another artist, or band out today. That's kind of,
well, it sounds to me like you're discussing the issue of authenticity.
Yes.
And perhaps
yes.
These bands that you're talking about aren't authentic.
Right.
Now that's interesting because when I showed up in Seattle in 1980, there was a lot of value placed on authenticity.
Right.
And because I was not authentic, I got some flack from the punk chicks on the Ave.
Oh, that's right. And you were telling me about one of those punk chicks on the Ave that kind of gave you flack for that. Who was that?
Oh, I don't know. She's a model now, I think, but she said, "You're a poser." And I said, well, if you call me a poser, then you're just being like the jocks and the preppies. And then she said, well, I guess you're a nice boy. But I was a poser.
Right, right. But you kind of put her in her place there a little bit. Now, was that you were telling me earlier, it was the lead singer from 7 Year Bitch or something like that? That was kind of, that was flipping you shit for being kind of a...
Well, we were friends.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to college and I started dressing preppy.
Right, right.
And then Stephanie, rest in peace, would not talk to me because I wasn't dressed punk.
Uh-huh.
And just the other day, a friend of mine said, well, I guess you weren't ever really punk because you aren't now. So if I had been punk, apparently I'd still be punk because there are plenty of people out there who are my age and they're still punk now.
Right, right. But they also, you know, sleep on a cardboard box. Sometimes.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
It all depends, right?
Yeah.
But that's real punk, right? Sleeping on a cardboard box?
Well, it was. I mean, I ended up, you know, being homeless and doing all kinds of weird things and proving that I was punk enough, even though maybe I wasn't. But I could at least put on a good show. So if you did something crazy or drink an excessive amount of beer or something like
right,
this, they would say, okay, you're okay.
Yeah.
And also, if you didn't go home, if you were still there in the morning, you were punk.
Yeah. And not much has changed, really. I mean, you know, we kind of, after kind of the grunge scene, too, that's you know, it seems like that's kind of always in every faction of society. That's kind of a thing. You know, whether you're a rich lawyer in downtown Seattle or downtown L.A., you know, you got to prove that you're, you know, you got to have the nice car. You got to have all the nice things to prove that you're somebody that you, you know, act like.
And then, you know, even with it, it follows all the way down to the punk rock scene, where if you don't drink 7 beers in 8 minutes, you're not punk or whatever.
Well, I actually did much better as a punk than as a grunger, because yeah. the grunge people did not put that much value on authenticity.
On anything.
No,
right.
they just wanted to have fun, drink right. a beer, right. and a lot of them had jobs, and they liked good music, and
right.
they didn't
right.
care for the really bad music that the punks were listening to at the time.
Yeah, and you said something interesting about that too, which kind of rang true to me too. It was like when you know the quote unquote grunge scene kind of started coming on, these guys actually knew how to play their instruments, and they were playing.
Right.
You know,
and they had instruments.
Right. Okay.
But it scared me a lot, because I realized that I was not going to have my street cred anymore. That it didn't mean anything anymore.
Right.
I remember the day when I realized that I was going down in society because of the arrival of grunge rock.
Right.
I was at a Red Cross show, and I go up to look at the band, and they have this long hair and these tight-fitting, glittering outfits, and they're swinging right. their hair around, and I just flipped out. I couldn't believe that they were doing that, so I started stealing beer and money out of the tip jar, and then the police uh-huh. came and dragged me away. And I started sobbing in the police car, saying, "Oh no, it was horrible." And the police said, "What? What?" And I said, "They were flinging their hair around, and I couldn't stand it. Pretty boys with their long hair." And so then the police let me go.
Because they agreed with you.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. They
totally
agreed with
knew
you.
What I was thinking about.
That's awesome. So a Red Cross. I don't think I recognize that. That name. I don't know if I had ever heard of Red Cross before.
Well, they started as punk, and then they grew uh-huh. their hair out, but they weren't really grunge.
Okay. So were they more like hair metal? Like Queensryche
no.
or something like that?
You'd probably call them proto-grunge. I don't know. Huh. You remember there was another band back then with long hair, the Cult, Southern Death Cult.
Southern Death Cult. I have heard of them, yes. I don't know if I've ever heard their music, though. I've heard the name mentioned.
It's basically, you know, if you can play your instruments and you play a lot of good guitar leads, then uh-huh. you're not punk anymore.
Right, yeah. Then you're changing to grunge, right?
In that direction.
Yeah. So you're still in Seattle at this point, at the age of, where are we now? Where are we now on the scale of life of Ben Guy Davis?
Well, I did move to San Francisco when I was 20.
Okay. So at what year was that when you went to San Francisco?
83, 84.
Okay. So that was kind of right when the grunge, I don't know, the kind of music was turning towards that path a little bit, right?
No, I don't really remember people growing their hair out till about 1988.
Okay. So that's where you draw the line in the sand of where the grunge scene was at when people started growing their hair out?
Yes, definitely. A whole flock of people went
right.
back to the suburbs, grew their hair out, and then showed up as if they just thought of it by themselves.
Right.
And
yeah.
so you'd see these people all of a sudden changing their entire style, and they want to be part of the new hair band thing because it's
right,
fun.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that was, I mean, the hair metal was huge for a while. I mean, bands like, you know, Guns N' Roses, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've got
Things
a Guns
like
N' Roses story.
Do you?
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
We were practicing at the church in Ballard, me and my band.
Uh-huh. What band were you in?
Weird Feeling Number 3.
Weird Feeling Number 3?
Right. We did a song called You Are Totally Good. And so it's the church in Ballard, and a lot of bands uh-huh. practiced out there. And so we show up, and one of the guys that we knew, you know, the bass player, Duff McKagan.
Yeah, Duff. He
had brought his band
Seattle.
There to practice.
Right.
And I used to follow Duff around to find out where the parties were. I didn't know him, but I knew mm-hmm. he'd be going to a party after the club. So downtown Seattle, I'd just follow him and get on the bus that he got on. So that's how I'd find out where the party was. But anyway, he showed up at the church and he brought his band with him. And I remember I said, "This band will never make it. They're totally unoriginal."
Boy, were you ever wrong, my friend.
And we tried to kick them out of the practice space because they were using the time that we paid for.
Really, really.
So was the church, got them to leave.
Was the church? It was set up in a fashion where you just like rent a room by the hour or something like that.
Well, a lot of us lived there and played music there and did art.
Gotcha.
And had parties.
Was it just just a couple rooms big or?
No, it was huge. It was a church.
Oh, okay, okay. So they were using your room?
The practice space that we had paid for. We'd paid the people who were in charge of the church.
Right.
We'd rented some practice time for
gotcha.
A weird feeling.
Gotcha. Nice, nice. And so that was actually Guns N' Roses that were in there? That was like Slash and Axl
and
Rose
then,
and everybody, huh?
Walter said, typical drummer.
So, now, this is when you came back from San Francisco when you formed this band up in Seattle?
Yes.
Okay, okay. So you're already back up here. The grunge era was starting to take effect. And you met this girl. Where did you meet Courtney Love? Where did you first run into Courtney Love?
Down in San Francisco.
Oh, down in SF. Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
So how did you come across, how did you meet her? What were the circumstances surrounding this this friendship, I guess you could say?
Well, I was at the time extremely foolish. So I was just like a clown hanging out on the street, up to no good. And I think she felt sorry for me because she would try to do things like bail me out of jail twice and let me sleep at her apartment.
Yeah, yeah.
And one time, she let me stay at her apartment. It was a great gig. Everybody wanted to stay there. And she said, now, don't do anything with my heroin. And so I was looking at that heroin while she was doing a audition.
Yeah. Had you had a history of doing something with somebody's heroin?
No. I'd done a little bit now and then, but I'd never really gotten high off it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't even know what you're supposed to do with it, so I just kind of ate it. So I ate her heroin. I didn't get high, and I get kicked out on the street.
Right, right. That's it? She kicked you out?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you came across Courtney Love a few times, right?
Yeah, she had this amazing ritual for getting ready for auditions. She was going to do that Sid Vicious movie.
Oh, she was going to be in Sid Nancy?
She was auditioning for the part of Nancy, right?
Really?
Nancy Spungen.
Okay.
And so she would get all her makeup out and put powder all over herself and get it all over the room. So she was taking the powder puffs and puffing her face up, and the powder was spreading all over the room. And then she says, what do you think I should take for my audition? Speed or heroin or both? And then...
So she was really trying to play the part then, huh?
Right. So then... Well, it wasn't really a part. She just was that way.
Then, right, right.
And then my friend says, why don't you just go for both?
So she pretty much took an eight ball before she went and auditioned for this show.
I guess so, but
for
she didn't
for
get the role.
Well, obviously, yeah, yeah. Who played? Do you know that actress's name? Yeah. She did a great job, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good movie. We're on a roll here. We're going to take our first break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk. We're going to talk some more with Ben here, Ben Guy Davis, here of Seattle, and we're going to talk a little bit more about his past, some run-ins that he had with Iggy Pop, and some more stories about Courtney Love if you got any here.
Excellent.
All right. Well, we'll be back in a little bit. This is Iggy Pop with "I Am a Passenger." We'll see you in a second.
And I ride through the city backsides. I see the stars come out of the sky. Yeah, the bright and hollow sky. You know it looks so good tonight. I am a passenger. I stay under glass. I look through my window so bright. I see the stars come out tonight. You see the bright and hollow sky. Over the city's ripped back sky. And everything.
And we have with us here the most interesting man in the world, Ben Guy Davis. Welcome back, Ben.
Thank you. I'm incredibly interesting and good-looking, and I would never lie.
Well, that's good
about the drugs. I never tried any drugs. I just like to talk.
Right, right. Okay, yeah. As many of us do. Right.
Right.
Well, welcome back to the show, everybody. So as we just heard this Iggy Pop song, and during the break you were telling me that you have actually met Iggy Pop.
Right. It was 1980. There was this party house in the University District called the Madhouse. It's a parking lot now. But he
approximately
showed up at
where was this house at?
By the Texaco.
Wait, where's the
on
Texaco?
45th.
On 45th.
45th and Roosevelt.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Gotcha.
So anyway, Iggy Pop shows up at the party, and he wasn't that famous at the time, but he was notorious. And he comes and he pours oil on the floor and gets some eggs out of the refrigerator and starts juggling the eggs.
Really?
And I said to him something like, "Why are you doing that? These are your friends." And he said, "Hey, this is punk rock." And then he got chased out of the party because apparently on an earlier trip to Seattle, he had given this girl the clap.
Not the band, the disease. The
sexually transmitted disease Iggy Pop had bequeathed to Lauren. And so everyone was angry at him, and they chased him away.
Right.
That was the only time I ever saw him.
And Lauren was, like you were telling me earlier, Lauren is just some...
Just a punk chick.
Punk chick that was kind of popular in this house. Right.
Exactly.
Right, right. So I would not put it past Iggy Pop to have all sorts of weird sexually transmitted diseases.
I don't know. You know, I didn't talk to him about that.
Well, you should have inquired, man. You had him right there. You could have asked him that question, you know? Shit. Anyway. Okay, so, well, that's kind of a, I mean, when he blew up and got famous, were you ever just like, oh my God, I met that guy, and he gave my friend Lauren the clap?
Yes, but then there was also Patti Smith. Patti Smith came to town a couple years earlier, and there were a bunch of people running around Seattle at the time who had names that were given to them by Patti Smith.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Like just like pet names or something?
Yeah, she
like
gave
what?
Them all pet names, like James Baby Teeth or Pony Marie.
Okay.
And so they stuck with the names that Patti Smith had given them.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
No shit.
She was punk.
To this day, well, she, I mean, you know, she was one of the founding members of the Runaways, right?
Right.
Right.
So Seattle was always kind of a naive place. You know, it was like the nice, friendly, younger brother of New York. And so
Right,
we never really got the edge, the meanness of some of the other punk scenes,
mm-hmm.
like the LA hardcore scene or the New York scene. When John Lydon came to play, he actually mocked the Seattleites.
Who is John Lydon?
From the Sex Pistols.
Okay.
With his band PIL.
PIL.
Right. So he sees this crowd of young kids in Seattle, all happy and extremely glad to be seeing the guy from the Sex Pistols.
Right, right.
And they're cheering, and they aren't doing a very good job addressing punk. And so he says, "Will you elect me for president?" And we all are like, "Yeah,
of course we will."
And then he says, "Then I will take the rest of this show sitting down." And so he actually sat down for the rest of the show.
No shit.
Right.
Where was that? Where was that show at?
The Showbox.
The Showbox.
Yeah. Yeah.
Showbox been around for a long time. You remember when the Rock Candy was around and OK
mm-hmm.
Hotel and,
mm-hmm.
and all those places? I think, what was the first show that you went to here in Seattle?
Devo.
Devo.
1980.
Really? Where at? Paramount?
No, it was at the Showbox too.
It was at the Showbox.
Yeah, we took acid and I took more than my friends, but my friends got too high, so high they had to go home. So I must have been even higher than they was. But I just had to see Devo. So I was alone downtown, surrounded by these really freaky art freaks who were like, before punk, there were art freaks downtown.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they were really kind of scary. But so then I saw Devo and I was completely convinced that they had not showed up, that they'd sent robots to the place because I thought no human being could dance with that much precision.
Were they wearing the honey? Was that the year that they... That kind of Whippet came out and
yes,
and We Are Not Men, We Are Devo, that album. Wasn't that, it was Whippet was on We Are Not Men, right? Wasn't that on?
Yes.
Yeah. There goes my electronic cigarette. Oh boy, can't drop those.
These are good.
Aren't they great?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Me and Ben, we're hanging out. I'm drinking my whiskey. Ben's got his electronic cigarette over here, and he's enjoying the shit out of it. It's great. I think we've peddled these electronic cigarettes on pretty much every episode since I got them, since I bought them. And they're working, man. They're great. They're great. Except for when Sean DeTore shows up and gives me actual cigarettes, which is totally not cool. So, Sean, if you're listening, totally not cool, dude. Okay. So before we went to the break, we were talking about Courtney Love and how you kind of ran into her. And you said you had some more stories with the good old Courtney.
Well, I actually got to be pretty good friends with her. And I know mm-hmm. that people in Seattle think she's the devil and they think that she killed Kurt Cobain. But
that's
I don't know.
Conspiracy I mean, theory. That's conspiracy theory.
She was always nice to me, nice and kind and helpful and very crazy and slutty and, you know, all that. But
doesn't make you a psychopath.
Right. So I was sitting downtown with her one time and she kind of thought I was a hippie. Uh-huh. You know, maybe I was. But she's like, I think you're kind of like a hippie. And I said, if I was a hippie, would I be downtown in the middle of the night on a park bench with you?
And so possibly.
Then she was okay with me.
Okay.
After
good,
that.
Good.
And then, like I said, she bailed me out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a band at that time with the girl from Babes in Toyland. And it was called the Italian Horror Nuns.
Okay.
And they were horrible. I mean, Courtney could not sing at all. So she knew that I was a pretty good singer. So she said, can you help me? How can I sing better? So I told her, well, don't worry about hitting the notes. Just sing really loud.
Right. Just belt it out. Right.
Right. And so we would practice singing Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin duets together.
Wow.
Right. So I have the honor of having helped Courtney Love learn how to sing.
By singing Dean Martin tunes.
Right.
And so then, what kind of tunes were you singing with her then? What songs?
Let's drink to your health. Nah, let's drink to your wealth. And then she'd go, you're my bon ami. Hey, that's French. Liberty, fraternity.
That's great. That's great. So did you ever have the chance to
have sex with her? No.
No.
She made a pass at me, but I was in love with her best friend. So,
oh, okay. Yeah. And even at that time, she might have had the herp or something like that. You know, you
I wouldn't have cared, I that. Don't think, at that time because I didn't expect to survive. But I heard she was very good.
Well, it sounds like she had a lot of experience, you know.
Yes.
So she should have been good.
Well, she was always trying to sleep her way to the top.
And
she did.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of something they hit on, too, in some of the documentaries that have been about Kurt and Courtney. I don't know. I can't remember the last documentary that I saw about them, their relationship. And that's kind of what it sounded like, is that she was trying to sleep her way up.
Well, I'm sure they were compatible, too. I mean,
oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I don't believe she killed him because the only time I ever met Kurt, he told me, after only having a 20-minute discussion with him, he told me that he had been in bed for months at a time, suicidally depressed.
Right, right.
So
he just came across as a really depressed person. Like,
right, but very intelligent.
Yeah, yeah, very, very smart
he
guy.
He was self-taught.
Very smart guy. Right, right.
And fond of existentialist literature.
Really?
Yes.
Cool.
Beckett.
Cool. Never knew that.
Beckett was his favorite writer.
No
he
shit.
Told me.
Huh. So that's pretty interesting. So you did have a chance to meet Kurt Cobain.
Right. Last time I did heroin, 1992.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you're doing heroin with Kurt Cobain. Apparently, did you do heroin with Kurt Cobain or?
Yeah. Well, they were out when I got there, so I said, "Can I get some?" So then we went to the dealers. That was like a couple blocks away.
Okay.
And it was the most skeezed out, disgusting heroin I've ever seen. I mean, this guy had a couple friends with a hypodermic needle trying to dig for gold in his neck, just gouging and gouging and gouging, trying to hit a vein.
Oh, my God.
And he's basically skin and bones. This is the dealer.
And this is the dealer.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
You know, you think dealers might be a little bit classier.
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
I couldn't believe it. These people looked like zombies or worse.
Jesus Christ. So, I mean, that was the last time you ever did heroin?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So was it just like seeing these people that kind of made you stop?
No, I already knew I wasn't going to be doing it much. I hadn't been doing it very much anyway, so.
Right, right. That's an intense drug, man. It's an intense drug.
Yeah, if I would suggest never even do it once.
Once, right, right. Because you know you'll love it.
No, for me it was, I became a bad person after I did it. Just a little tiny bit made me bad.
How so?
I just lost my inspiration, my hope, my self-respect, everything all at once, overnight.
So an instant depressive.
Yes, and I no longer could stand on a chair and tell my story to people because I didn't have anything to say. I was a loser. You know, I was just one of those burned out heroin people.
Now, were you just focusing on that? Or were you just like, you were like, oh, I'm a loser because I've done this? Or
no, I think it does that to your chemistry. You don't want to do anything. You don't feel like saying anything. But also you do feel ashamed, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, you know, in a lot of cases, especially in the 90s, people were doing heroin and they were writing these amazing songs. Like,
they must have had some coke with it. You can't write the songs if you're just on heroin, right?
Right,
you need, like, some LSD and some heroin together, which we call a cheese ball. A
cheese ball?
Yeah.
Shit, that's like a log of Velveeta right there.
Mm-hmm.
Straight into your veins.
It's great.
So wait a minute. How would you do a cheese ball? You smoke it?
No, you eat the acid.
You eat the acid and then shoot the heroin.
Smoke the heroin.
Smoke the heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, okay. So I hope you're listening and taking notes here on the Air Raid podcast. For a cheese ball, you eat the acid, smoke the heroin. Have you got that right written down? Okay, good. All right, let's move on here. Let's move on. So what was, I think, didn't they hit on this documentary that I saw with Kurt and Courtney. They interviewed that dealer, I think, that you're talking about. Because didn't that dealer, like, he had his own band or something like that, and he was kind of sucking the teat of
I don't think it's the same
Kurt's
one.
Oh, no?
No.
No? That guy, I mean, it sounds like if they were digging for a vein on that guy, he's probably dead by now, right?
Yeah, I can't. You never know.
Yeah.
Like no. I said, I thought I was going to be dead for sure.
Right, right. Yeah, that's shit, man. That's crazy. So you didn't meet Kurt any time after that, or did you run into Courtney any time after that too, or did you kind of lose touch with them after they kind of? I mean, because that's like right before they kind of started blowing up, right?
Right.
Was Kurt in Nirvana at that point? He must have been. Yeah.
Yes, and I saw them a few months later driving down the street in a limousine, and this is when they'd really hit it big.
Right, right.
And they looked very depressed.
Uh-huh.
And then I went and I left a message for Courtney a year later to see her play, and it was really a good show.
What was the play? She wrote a play?
No, to see her play in Hole.
Oh,
downtown.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Gotcha. And well, Hole kind of after Nirvana got big, Hole kind of took off a little bit too, right?
Yeah, Hole was a really good show. She put on a great show.
Yeah, and she was at Bumbershoot. She just came up to Bumbershoot in Seattle. Did you get to see her at that?
I didn't head down there that night. I wanted to, but I was busy.
Yeah, I heard it was kind of a train wreck.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
It's too bad.
She needs help.
She definitely
Courtney,
needs help.
Give me a call. Thanks for all your help.
Yeah, if you're listening, Courtney. Come on, we want to help you out here. We want to get you well. You know, we're not those people that just talk shit about you.
Let's do a duet.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, let's do some Dean Martin here on the Air Raid podcast. Courtney, you come on the Air Raid podcast. We'll do some Dean Martin duets here. Yeah, with Ben Guy Davis.
Yeah, but Kurt and Courtney were very authentic people who would say what they were thinking. And that's part of the reason why I think they ended up together, because they would just say what was on their mind.
Right,
and
right.
Courtney was always pissing everybody off because she would tell you what you were thinking. And usually she was right. Uh-huh. And this would really piss off the people who were thinking things that they were embarrassed about thinking.
Like what? Give me an example here.
Oh, she would tell some girl that she'd say something like, well, you wish you were like me, and that's why you're mad at me, because I'm getting all the attention.
Right, right.
And so then the girl would be really pissed off, and everybody would say they hated Courtney.
Right, right. Well, I mean, you gotta confess though. That's kind of a bitchy thing to say, right?
Yeah, she was bitchy, but she just wanted to see, she just wanted to see if you could hold your own.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah.
You had to be able to say something.
Yeah,
not just sit there.
Yeah, well, and you gotta. I mean, would she respect people who kind of stood up to her and were just like,
yes,
you know, well, fuck you, whore. You know, or you know, not like that. I mean, I don't know what people would say. You know, in response to, you know, oh, you just want to be like me. I mean, but she would respect people who kind of stood up to her and put her in her place.
I think what she respected was if you said what you were actually thinking.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you can't make something up because that, you know, that's inauthentic, right? But if you actually say what you're actually thinking, I think Kurt was the same way, because like when I met him, he cut right to the chase.
Uh-huh.
He said, "What do you do?" was the first words he said to me.
Right. What was your answer?
Which is pretty direct. I said, "I'm a songwriter and a poet," which is pretty stupid, but at least I thought of something to say.
Right, right. So, I see, I'm looking at your list here right now too. And you have met, and were involved with Bruce Luce of Flipper.
Oh, right. He hated me. By the way,
why did he hate you? What did you do?
Because I was a poser. He was just like, this guy's some guy from the woods. What a doofus, you know.
Back to the poser thing, man.
Yeah, he actually, but you know, he was nice enough. I really liked his band, so I'd go see his shows.
Uh huh. Well, Flipper is still around too, and Chris Novoselic he's playing with Flipper now, right? He's a bass player.
I believe Bruce Luce is still alive.
Is Bruce Luce still alive? He's not playing. Is he playing with Flipper? I haven't seen Flipper. They played with a band, a friend's band, Helmsley, with Ben Varellen, a little while back down at Hell's Kitchen in Tacoma. And I know that Chris Novoselic is playing in that band now.
Right.
I had never heard of Flipper before. Helmsley was playing with them. So I don't know, what did Bruce Luce play? What was he?
He's a bass player. They were a San Francisco band, and the music was actually better than most of the punk at the time, because they weren't LA hardcore, which was really boring. They were just basically a jam band, you know, radical, interesting. And the San Francisco scene was a lot more freeform and artistic than the LA scene. So the music, but some of the bands back then couldn't play at all. So they have Mud Women, who would get
Mud
up on
women.
Stage kind of naked and just bang around on their instruments and couldn't even really play.
Kind of like a Gwar concert.
Something like that, yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. So how did you meet this guy Bruce Luce then?
I was dating his ex-girlfriend. And maybe that's why he didn't like me.
That's awkward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When they broke up, he jumped out the window, but he didn't get hurt. So then he tried to do it again. He still
the
didn't
window
get
of
hurt.
What? Like their apartment?
Yeah, second story window.
Holy shit.
So he jumped
man.
Out of it twice, didn't get hurt. So then he takes the car and runs the car into the house. But, you know, he's a survivor.
Yeah. Well, apparently. Holy crap. That's a lot of surviving that guy's done. You know?
Yeah, but he was a nice guy.
Okay, okay.
But his, one of the guys from that band died, so that was kind of sad. Will Shatter.
Will Shatter. Mm-hmm. I just saw this on your list, and like I was trying to tie it in. This is how good of a host, radio host I am, because I'm trying to tie in the Flipper with the Nirvana and the fact that Chris Novoselic is now in Flipper, and it didn't work out. And I'm sorry. And I apologize to everybody.
Yeah, and then Faith No More was around too. We were all like
oh, that's
part of
right.
the same
and you,
group
you
in
had
San
told
Francisco.
Me, right?
Flipper,
right.
Faith No More. They were these pretty intelligent, interesting people who like Faith No More. They liked pop music.
So right,
they,
right.
They would listen to that commercial Nestle's makes the very best, and try to come up with a song like that.
Uh huh. Yeah. So you were saying earlier that Courtney Love was like
she was the original
singer for Faith No More,
and she was dating the piano player for Faith No More.
No shit.
Roddy Bottom, who's a wonderful person.
Really? Mm-hmm. Really? So, and that was down in SF. That was in San Francisco. So how did you see any of their shows with Courtney Love?
Yeah, I was a big fan. I went to all the shows and pretty much got in for free. Because if you were in a band back then in San Francisco, you'd get into the shows for free. And so sometimes I'd walk in backwards, but I did get in. And then they had a song about Mad Pad. That's the only song I remember, Mad Pad. But
And they were actually Faith No More at that time, too?
They were called Faith No More.
Really?
Yeah, but they didn't they didn't sound anything like
Hits. I wouldn't imagine.
No, they were punk, I think, at the time.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. So that's pretty cool, though. I mean, I never knew that. I never knew that. That's something you can find out on, like, a Wikipedia or something like that? That Courtney Love was the original singer of Faith No More?
Yes.
You're sure on that?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Well, I think that does it for us here. This has been a really a real treat having you on the show, Ben.
Oh, thanks. It's all lies, by the way. I just made it up off the top of my head. I've never done drugs, and I never met any of those people. Thanks a lot.
So, what you also do you own the business that you work in right now?
Seattle Green Painting.
Seattle Green Painting. Okay, and we can check that out where? Do you have like a website or a Facebook page or anything like that?
www.seattlegreenpainting.com.
All right. And if you need any painting on your home or your office, we can give you a call and
we're a drug-free company.
Drug-free company. Great. I love that. Well, you'll be happy to know that nobody actually listens to this show. So, you're safe.
Oh,
you're
good.
You're safe. Yeah. Yeah. But check out Ben Guy Davis. I've looked at some of your pictures online, and you are a great painter, sir.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I love it. I dig it. I dig the art, and I dig the style that you paint. I used to actually paint in college for a small painting company, and I found it to be very relaxing. I was never very good at it. Like, I didn't do it long enough to where I could just, you know, do a real straight line, you know, with a brush or anything like that. But man, it was very zen trying to get that.
Yeah, I'm almost a master now.
Are you? How long you been doing it?
15 years.
15 years.
Yeah.
All right.
So once again, I'd like to apologize to the people for talking.
Oh.
And I'm an idiot. Thanks.
No, not at all, man. It's been a lot of fun having you here. We enjoy the conversation. Remember, you can check us out on www.air-raid.net. Please email me to Aaron, that's A-A-R-O-N, at air-raid.net. And you can also find us on Stitcher, which you can download onto your smartphones, and Zune Marketplace. And once again, let's keep our fingers crossed. We're going to be up on iTunes soon. With the help of Mr. Steve Jobs, who we love. Okay, this is Sonic Youth Incinerate. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.